Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about elements of the Scriptures that have made them more real for us because we believe that helps us draw more power out of them, and we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Kerry Muhlstein, and I am honored and excited to have with us as our guest today, Dr. Richard Bushman. Welcome, Dr. Bushman.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here. Maybe I'll tell our audience just a little bit about you, and then we'd love to hear from you a little bit more. But Dr. Bushman is really an eminent historian. He taught at Columbia, the Governor Morris Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. He taught at BYU and Harvard and Boston and the University of Delaware. You may know him as the author of what I think is the best biography written on Joseph Smith, the Rough Stone Rolling, a book that is I very much appreciate. And I'm actually have been working my way through On the Road with Rough Stone Rolling, where Dr. Bushman talks about what it was like as that was happening. I'll also just personally say I was fortunate to, I think it was in 2008, so that's a while ago, but Dr. Bushman came fairly regularly to BYU to do history workshops, and I was fortunate to be part of one of those one summer, and just learned a tremendous amount, both about the history he had us write. And he, if I remember correctly, I wanted to do just Book of Abraham stuff. And you said, one of your topics has to be something different to force me to branch out. And actually, I've been grateful for that ever since. But I will just say the true epitome of a scholar and a gentleman, just a good, good, kind man. Also part of the Joseph Smith Papers Project, serves as a patriarch. What else should we know about you?
Well, I'm thoroughly married.
Yes.
I have six children and 20 grandchildren and so on. So I, at this stage of life, I'm truly enjoying my family as well as dibs and dabs of scholarship.
Well, wonderful. And today we have, again, just thank you for being with us, but today we have fantastic stuff to cover, only a few sections, and yet the history behind these sections is really incredible, and there's no way we could cover all of that. So we'll just dive into whatever you would like to dive into. So where would you like to take us? What would you like to talk about?
Well, this is a delicious section to me. I think it's filled with interesting tensions. And it's a landmark revelation. And part of it that it's the first revelation that given that was recorded. Section one was a preface that came along when the first collection of revelations came out. And section two is an excerpt from Moroni's visit to Joseph Smith that was written up in 1838 as a part of the church history at that time. And section three in the summer of 1828, that's when there's still, we're in the middle of translating the Book of Mormon, is really the first time we hear Joseph Smith speaking in his revelatory voice other than the Book of Mormon. This is the first revelation in chronological order that's in our current Doctrine and Covenants.
And it's part of, as you said, it's part of a fascinating story. This is really part of the translation of the Book of Mormon, really section three and five, and in some ways four as well. But it's at least part of that time period and what Joseph is experiencing. But as you said, a story with tensions and ups and downs, and it's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually excruciating stuff.
Yeah.
Because Joseph Smith and Martin Harris had been working from the winter through the spring on translating. And, you know, that's a huge moment in Joseph Smith's life when he suddenly finds he can translate. And they produce these 116 pages. which Martin Harris, always little and easy about everything that's going on, wants more proof, despite his support of Joseph, he's always sort of teetering. And he asks for permission to show the manuscript to his wife, because she also was unsure of Joseph Smith, suspected him, and yet wondered. So Joseph inquires and finally gets permission to let him take the manuscript. And then Joseph, they'd been working up in Manchester, and then Joseph heads south to Harmony, where Emma's living and about to give birth to their first child, which she does. But then the child immediately dies.
Yeah. So that's the day after Martin leaves with the manuscript, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly the dates there.
But it's very close, yeah.
It's very close. He heads south. It's a fairly long journey. It'd be, you know, a day's journey those days. And the baby is born and dies immediately.
Yeah.
So there you have his own sorrow and his first son's death. His poor wife suffering from having lost a baby and very depressed. And then all the time in the back of his mind, this terrible worry about what's happening to Martin and the manuscript. So finally, Emma looks at him and says, look, I appreciate you wanting to take care of me, but you've got to go north and find out about that manuscript. After all, she has an investment in this. Yeah. This is his big life project. And if it fails, what else comes down? Where is he then? So he takes a coach north, can't quite get to Manchester on the coach, has to walk through the night. Finally gets home, has breakfast. Martin Harris suddenly appears at the opening of their property, but doesn't come in the house. He just sort of waits, sits on the fence, ponders, looks up into the sky. Eventually, they get him in the house. And by this time, of course, Joseph is frantic, and he confesses he has lost the manuscript. Hmm. Showing it to his wife, and then he got excited about it and showed it to friends. And then she locked it away in her drawer, and he wanted to show it to another friend. So he pries open the door to get the manuscript out. And then when he puts it back and goes to look for it again, it's gone. And he hunts in search. He's frantic. He's miserable. And when he tells Joseph about this, Joseph went berserk. He was just at wit's end. His mother said he cried back and forth, all is lost, all is lost. And, this huge, strange, wonderful visit, project. And now it all seems collapsed. And Joseph believes it's his fault. He shouldn't give way to Martin.
I remember correctly, and tell me, you can correct me, but according to his mother, I think he says that he asked Martin if Martin has condemned both of them, which gives you the idea Joseph feels that because of this loss, he is condemned.
Yeah, right. And with good cause, the Lord entrusted us with him. And so then this revelation comes. And it's, in a way, merciless. And the Lord just does condemn him and says, you've given way to the appeals of a man. You've listened to a man's voice rather than heeding my voice. And just really kind of beats up on him. Finally relents in the 10th verse and says, but you're not cast off forever. And, but threatens him with what is very interesting. The threat is not with damnation, not the wrath of God, but the loss of your gift. Mm. And you'll just be as other men, which I think is an interesting insight into Joseph Smith's feeling about himself. He had come to realize that, yes, he's not an ordinary person. He's not just one more farm boy. He has a special gift. And he'd come to love that. It was using it. I think it must have been pleasurable for him to translate. He did it day after day. He needed some kind of boost. And now it's going to be gone. It looked good. And then tells him he is forgiven and to get back to work, and the Lord promises him he will be restored. So it's an interesting revelation of how the Lord thought of Joseph Smith, and how Joseph Smith thought about the Lord, because the revelations are a little ambivalent about this. On one hand, he's told, you're my friend, you're my friend. And the Lord says to Joseph Smith, but Joseph Smith always had a fear of disobeying God. He was also, there's a side that, you know, you don't fool around with this divine person. You have to really measure up. So it's filled, I think, with that sort of excruciating psychologies and insights in where Joseph was.
Maybe if it's all right, you've said a number of things I'd love to explore a little bit more with you. One of those might be, as you said, this interesting thing that, that this is a gift he's received from God. And he's, by this point, just by the time he can get the plates, he's been tutored by God that you use that gift for the glory of God, not for other things. That's something that's really important, that I have a lecture on our Patreon website that we explore a little bit. But he's definitely been tutored that he knows that this gift is for the glory of God. And yet still, my guess would be, and I'd love your insight on this as a patriarch, that that the gift is a burden and a blessing. I would guess that you approach patriarchal blessings the same way, that you take this very seriously. You know you need to be the Lord's mouthpiece, and doing it the right way is a burden in terms of you really want to do it the right way. But then I would guess that the as the Spirit directs you, that's a wonderful experience as well.
Well, yes, I think it's a very good comparison, though this scale is a little different in the translation case. But there is that feeling that you have to be worthy. I mean, you can't compromise with yourself if you're going to have the Spirit of the Lord to be with you. And that those words that came in the revelation Joseph Smith given to Oliver Cowdery, about you have to search it out in your own mind. You know, that's an intellectual search, but I think it has to be done morally in a way that's deeply reverent and, you know, beseeching God for the words to come. I think he learned very quickly that you just cannot do this unless your heart is in mind or focus. You have to do it with real intent, as the scriptures say, when you pray.
Yeah. Wonderful. And maybe we could explore a little bit, and maybe you really want to go into depth in this or not, I don't know, but I like how you highlight the kind of transition almost in section 3, that you have these verses where Joseph is called on the carpet pretty clearly. And then you get that transition in verse 10 that you talked about. And it almost seems to me, so maybe we can cast this in light of two things. One, if Joseph does feel like he's condemned, then verses 1 through 8 are, or in some ways 9 is kind of start of the transition, that he's expecting that. he's expecting God to absolutely tell him what he did wrong. And yeah. He really does feel condemned. So in some ways, just the fact that you get verse 9, 10, and onwards must be a relief to him. In some ways, this is a merciful section, but that first part's not. It kind of reminds me of section 121 and what Joseph Smith will tell us later, that you reprimand or chasten with sharpness, and then you show forth a love after that. And I feel like we're seeing God do that with Joseph here a little bit. I don't know if you have thoughts on that or what you'd like to talk about in that section.
Well, I do. You know, for a while I thought, gee whiz, couldn't God give Joseph Smith a break here? But I think Joseph Smith knew he'd made a mistake. And, you know, he's so reluctant all along, and then he gave way. Yeah. And I think at this point, he actually needed a tongue lashing. That was sort of a purging moment. God says, yes, I am angry with you. And then having borne that burden, received that punishment, verbal punishment, then it sort of cleanses him. He's paid the price. Now let's lay that aside and we can go on to the next step.
And I wonder if you could for us, I think if we really want to understand, you're right, Joseph gave way, right? He knew, and he just kept asking. There was a lot of pressure on him. Maybe we don't understand the role that Martin Harris is playing in terms of supporting Joseph in translation of the Book of Mormon. I don't know if you have anything you could explain in terms of that.
Well, Martin plays a very interesting role. He's the one person of among the very earliest followers who had any standing in the town. That is, when critics would talk about the early followers of Joseph Smith, they made fun of all of them. None of them are people of property. You know, the Smiths have a little farm, but they aren't established as farmers. They're just getting started. Martin Harris is the one who had some respect, and they always have to diminish, the critics always have to diminish Martin Harris by saying, yeah, but he had some crazy religious ideas. But he came, and he was able to give Joseph Smith money. He could pay for the movement to Harmony, where the translation took place. And that sort of showed his independence. But he was a torn man because he knew he was moving to the side of what Protestants would call superstition, that is, belief in phony miracles, and that people would ridicule Joseph Smith, that is, the distinguished people, the doctors and the ministers and the lawyers and the printers and the merchants, sort of the respectable city, a segment of the town, would ridicule Joseph Smith. But he was willing to take a chance because he was enthralled by it. And so was his wife. They both were very interested, but uneasy. You know, their social position sort of caused a divide in their mind. Should they go with the respectable or should they go with the ignorant peasants of the town? And he was taken by it. But all the way through, even after he had made all these commitments, helped Joseph Smith and agreed to help translate, he keeps going back and says, well, is there any chance I could see the plates? Or, you know, always these questions. He's interesting because of where he sort of is situated in the world, and also that his commitment had this sort of underside of uncertainty. He couldn't quite make it a wholehearted commitment. But the Lord was tolerant with him, made him one of the witnesses.
He finances, we'll get to this later in the year, but he finances the publication of the Book of Mormon as well.
Published at great cost, loses his wife, loses his farm because of it. So you can't really Martin Harris. He did a heck of a lot. Crucial figure in the early Restoration.
And you mentioned his wife, and so maybe I can put somewhere forward, and you correct me in all the different places that I'm wrong, but I think his wife also ends up being a real element of pressure in this that in some ways is behind both Section 3 and 5. And in some ways that also means she's behind 10. As you said, she was initially very interested. I think she even made one of the trips to Harmony because she's so interested in this. But like you said, probably also worried about where this stands and wants some proof to tell other people that she's not being duped. And she kept wanting to see the plates. And when Joseph wouldn't show them the plates, while Martin stayed supportive, still asking questions, but supportive of Joseph Smith, Lucy Harris very much turned against him, and as a result turned against Martin, because Martin was continuing to support Joseph, that she is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Martin to be able to see the plates. And the idea of showing her the translation is kind of hoping for a compromise, a middle ground, to be able to show her something. I think they even end up sleeping in different houses before this is all done and before his marriage ends, but during some of what we're reading about here, because that pressure is destroyed. And I think there are probably other things going on as well, but it's part of what's destroying the marriage. Am I incorrect in that? Or
no, I think that's absolutely right. And Martin does say that when he showed her the manuscript, she was astounded and sort of softened. And it was the fact that the manuscript had that influence on his wife led him to want to show it to all his friends who were also skeptical. So he got sort of tricked by Lucy Harris's favorable response.
Well, wonderful. Thank you. I don't know if you have more you'd like to talk about with Section 3, or if you'd like to move on, or what would you like to talk about?
I'd like to talk more about Section 3.
Okay.
I think Section 3 is a marvel, because I would say this is the point at which Joseph Smith found his prophetic voice. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Most scriptures are a report on what God said.
Yeah.
Isaiah, you know, quotes the Lord, but it's Isaiah did thus and so. Yeah. In the Book of Mormon, it's I, Nephi, and God revealed to me. And the same with Mormon and Moroni. But Section 3 and most of the sections thereafter, there is no intermediary. It is God himself is speaking right into our ears. And that is a characteristic of most Doctrine and Covenants, or certainly most Book of Commandments revelations from then on. It's a distinctive voice, unlike any other scripture. And this is coming on early. You know, Joseph Smith begins translating in earnest somewhere in the winter of 1828. And that is an incredible moment, because he has to have learned how to translate, which he didn't know how to do, didn't think he could do, was searching for someone else to help him translate. Finally, something happens. It's a very mysterious moment. I cannot say how it works, but he begins dictating, and then the dictation just comes pouring forth from him. Now, with this first written revelation, he does something else. That is, he speaks for the Lord, and right into our ears. And Section 76 is an exception. It's a report of Joseph and Sidney about a great revelation. But most other revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants are in that voice. And so I think that's critical to the growth of the church, because it's part of Joseph Smith's authority that he can be in a room and speak And it's not just Joseph Smith telling people, it's the voice of God coming to them. And a great, you know, enhanced that early group's sense that the Lord is with us. He is speaking through a prophet. So in that sense, I think it's a very critical moment when this revelation is brought forth.
That's beautiful. And maybe I could flesh that out a little bit. Just, I mean, you referenced Isaiah, and I think that's probably the prophet that besides Joseph has the most words that are, it's often prefaced with thus saith the Lord, but sometimes not, but where he speaks, I mean, you just hear God speaking and almost first person, yeah. God. And you have a lot of verses in Isaiah that do that, but even so, it's the smaller percentage of verses in, that's a long prophetic book, the longest of them, but still, it's the smaller percentage of that. Whereas, as you said, the Doctrine and Covenants is much longer than the book of Isaiah, and it's almost all like that. And I find this interesting, so I'd like your take on this as well. It seems like this revelation comes, well, Martin Harris is asking Joseph for information. Well, that's actually more section 5, but this is Joseph trying to find out what he should do. But this seems to open the floodgates so that after this, what we get is people seem to have realized, wait, Joseph can ask God for information and God will give a revelation to people about this. And so then you get section 4, which is to his father. And then you get a whole slew of revelations that are people saying, well, what does God want to say to me? And then you even get things like, okay, well, we can't write a preface to the book, so what is God, or at least a very good one, will God give us that, or will God give us this, will God tell us that? And it's almost that they figured out, wow, Joseph can do this if we ask him to do it. Kind of reminds me of what the brother of Jared must have been doing for Jared when Jared says, go ask God this, right? And then, boom, here comes a revelation.
Right. Well, and there's this rather amusing case of John Whitmer is called to be historian of the church, keep a record. And he says, I don't think I can do that. He said, and Joseph says, well, you've got to do it. And he says, I'll need a revelation. Joseph Smith gets a revelation, comes back and shows it to him and says, well, okay, if God wants to.
So it's funny because it was clearly a revelation, just not a whole written out word for word revelation that made Joseph go ask him in the first place, but he needed this kind of a document.
Yeah. So I think it's a special gift giving to a man who had no prophetic credentials. He had the Book of Mormon. That's pretty good. But, you know, he's not learned. He hadn't been brought up to this. And he's going out among people who are his equals, just people like himself in terms of education or experience. And he needed something that would grab them and convince them. And that gift went a long ways, I think.
And it's still a blessing for us today. I am still incredibly moved today as I read those words, especially the, and we'll get to the later to where you get this slew of sections that start out with Christ describing himself. I am Alpha and Omega. I am the one who has suffered for you. And it's moving for me to hear Christ speak about himself and then speak to us first person. It affects me.
Yeah. No, and that is glorious language. Yeah. I mean, we think, well, that's the way God speaks. But in terms of it coming from Joseph Smith, it's pretty wonderful. I mean, that's true for section 3, those opening verses of section 3. You know, the works and the designs and the purposes of God cannot be frustrated, neither can they come to naught. You know, yeah. That's a great opening.
Yeah. And must have been, by the way, incredibly reassuring to Joseph, who may feel like, okay, we've just ruined this whole Book of Mormon thing. God was trying to do something, and because I messed up, what God was trying to do is not going to happen. And that, even though it's part of the getting after Joseph, it's probably still somewhat relieving to hear, no, your stupidity and the evil designs of other people, none of that is going to stop me from doing what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And there were occasional moments when that gift was suspended for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1833, after they got news that the Saints had been driven out of Jackson County, the city of Zion, Joseph couldn't get a revelation for a couple of months. And you know, he was almost frantic. Nothing seemed to come. Finally, I think it was by December, a revelation did come. And it was a huge relief to him.
Yeah, well, in fact, I think it's this section, and again, you know far more than me, correct me if I'm wrong, but there may be that some of Section 10 is received at around the same time Section 3 is. We don't know, but it seems like Section 10 may have come in stages. But if I understand correctly, this section, he's lost the translators, or what we often refer to as the Urim and Thummim. And Moroni appears to him and gives him those translators, or the Urim and Thummim, just so he can receive this revelation, which gets after him. And but he'd lost the gift, not just of translation, but really of almost anything. Yeah. Until Moroni comes back. And it must be an interesting thing. Like, I'm going to restore this long enough so that I can tell you why you lost it.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk again later, is almost what this section is.
Well, that's true. And that, you know, that piques our curiosity, because we wonder just how those interpreters function.
Yeah.
But here, you know, it's partly he's a prophet, but partly he needs a little crutch. He needs to hold on to that, those interpreters, in order to. And it led to the sense that the interpreter revelations were more likely to be authentic than the ones he just received to himself. You know, it took David Whitmer a while before he could be, he didn't really trust Joseph Smith without the interpreters.
That's an interesting point. That may be part of why he says, okay, I need that.
Yeah.
And over time, I mean, the revelations here at the beginning are almost all through the Urim and Thummim, but that decreases over time to where you don't really see that very much in the end. So it seems like he's being tutored even in revelatory abilities.
Yeah, right. Well, it's some kind of gift that Joseph had, and he thought, well, probably anyone could do it. You know, he thought Oliver Cowdery could translate if he really worked at it a little bit. So he sees it, you know, not as his unique gift, but as something that's available to all people. It's just like in the temple, built up to the Kirtland Temple. He thought everyone could see God, just like he had. And that was the aim. So in a way, he's very egalitarian about these marvelous gifts that he had in abundance.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, okay. Where would you like to go from here?
Well, that's basically what I had in my mind when we got started.
Okay. If it's all right, I'd like to ask you maybe just a couple of questions about Section 5, just some ideas I've had about it, and then if you you can tell me whether you think I'm crazy or not. But my understanding is that Section 5 is the part of the historical context is, so this is later. We had it's not quite a year later, but almost a year later. Joseph has started translating again. He's got Emma has been helping him, but now a lawsuit is being drummed up against Joseph, and maybe partially against Martin. But in any case, and it's about fraud. Martin is giving him money, and I think Lucy Harris is part of this. But Martin's giving him money, but because he claims to have gold plates, but he doesn't have gold plates. He doesn't show anyone, so we can't trust him. This kind of a thing. And so Martin is going to be called into court. My understanding is he does call into court and testify, and Joseph is the case is dismissed. But I think this is before that, as Martin is contemplating needing to go to court And he comes back to Joseph, and it's a gap in between. I don't know. Do you know if Joseph and Martin have corresponded at all between when they have this terrible, terrible incident of saying, you know, Martin, if you condemned both of us there in Palmyra, and suddenly he's almost a year later in Harmony asking Joseph, can I see the plates? Can I please see the plates?
This is the period when our records are thinner, this first 10 years or so. So I'm not aware of any evidence of that.
Yeah. And lack of evidence doesn't mean it didn't happen, right? But we just don't know of it happening. But
that's right.
But anyway, it seems like Martin is just desperate again because so many people are putting so much pressure on him and his wife and maybe the court to know about the plates, and that this comes as a result of Martin's just desperate desire to see the plates to be able to say, I've seen them, it's real. Am I getting the context of this revelation correctly?
Well, I think so. I mean, that's what I was trying to say before. You know, he circulates with people as sort of friends and equals who are sort of the Enlightenment had touched. You know, they're the educated people who believed reason had to prevail. And Joseph Smith, you know, he still has treasure-seeking culture. He's part of that lower, superstitious, poor class. So he's never going to be able to escape that entirely, Martin. So I think that's quite likely that he would come and say, please give me some evidence. He needed to maintain the respect of his fellows of his social class.
Wonderful. Thank you. So along those lines, I just find this line in section 5 so interesting, where he says, verse 5, verily I say unto you that woe shall come unto the inhabitants of the earth if they will not hearken unto my words, for hereafter you shall be ordained and go forth and deliver my words unto the children of men. For if they will not believe my words, they would not believe you, my servant Joseph, if it were possible that you should show them all things which I have committed unto you. Oh, this unbelieving and stiff-necked generation, mine anger is kindled against them. Verily I say unto you, I have reserved those things which I have entrusted unto you, my servant Joseph, for a wise purpose in me, and it shall be known unto future generations, but this generation shall have my word through you. So that seems to me to be part of that call that you're talking about, this idea that Joseph, you and Martin also, he's addressing Martin almost incidentally as he addresses Joseph, right? But he wants Joseph to get this, and Martin will learn his answer through it. But he's telling Joseph, look, you, Martin, whoever, could show people all sorts of stuff, and they're not going to believe because of what they see. They're only going to believe because of what they hear from you, my prophet, and you are the way. If anyone's going to get my word in this generation, it's through you. That's the one source.
Yeah.
So I, at least to me, that speaks to what you were talking about earlier about Joseph. And we saw it in section 3 first, but then here in section 5, the continuation of Joseph realizing what it means to be a prophet and to speak for God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see some cross currents here. One, there is a problem of establishing Joseph's authority that runs through all these years, because the common response to anyone who claims to be a prophetic voice is that it sort of engenders all sorts of other prophetic voices, so that you get to sort of get a cacophony or get a competition who is the one to have authority. And Joseph Smith runs into that very early, you know, in the summer of 1830, that there are others who claim that they have the gifts of prophecy.
Yeah, with Hiram Page, right?
And if we went that in the direction that everybody can be a prophet, it could just rip the whole movement into shreds. So this is part of that effort. On the other hand, the way I say there's cross currents is Joseph Smith deeply yearned for others to have the same experience. So the whole purpose of the temple is to bring others into the presence of God. There was this hope that everyone could be the Lord's prophet and speak in his voice. And then, you know, you get the passages on everyone has the gift of the Holy Ghost and they shall speak scripture. So later on, you know, they were fairly freewheeling. And I think one of the miracles of the church is that it has disciplined that. So every bishop, every Relief Society president yearns for revelations, seeks it, receives it, without it all sort of tearing the whole church into pieces. So the balance worked out pretty well. But at this point, the thrust has to be to establish Joseph as the prophet, the head of the church. And that's been part of our tradition ever since.
And as you were saying that, I couldn't help but think about it. I see really strong parallels with this period of church history and the beginning of the movement with Israel under Moses and Aaron. And Joseph certainly wasn't confident in his language or his ability to write or speak. Moses certainly isn't. So he's turning to Aaron. Joseph is turning to Oliver Cowdery, who is sometimes described as kind of an Aaron for him. Moses also said very specifically he wanted all of Israel to be prophets. Everyone should prophesy in the name of the Lord. He wants to bring all of Israel into God's presence at Sinai in a very temple-like experience. And yet he repeatedly has both Aaron, his brother, and his sister Miriam, and then Korah, and a whole group of other people that are challenging his authority to receive revelation for everyone. And they have to work this out in the same way. I think it's a really strong parallel. And this idea of stewardship that we'll learn in section 28 and so on, but I think it's being taught here as well. And revelation is what has kept the church upright in the midst of those cross currents that you mentioned.
Yeah. No, it's quite a marvel. I think the church organization is one of the great revelations of the dispensation.
Wonderful. Well, maybe we can do this if it's okay with you. In a minute, I want to ask you just a little bit about your experience as a historian, but then we'll end the podcast. But then maybe you could visit with me for just a couple of minutes about Section 4 and just tell us a little bit about Joseph Smith Sr. and what's been going on in his life as he received Section 4. And we can put that on the Patreon website. That's tsar.website for those who are interested in that. But if you'd be okay with that, I'd love to do that just for 5 minutes or so.
Sure, that'd be fine.
But I'd love to ask you as we wrap up here, you are a historian. That's who and what you are. I mean, besides, you're also a father and a member of the church and a patriarch and all those identities. But your professional identity is a historian. And you have read as much about Joseph Smith as anyone. You're very familiar with the good things that happened in his life and the tough things that happened in his life. You've had to learn how to speak to non-believers and to believers about Joseph Smith. And you've done all of this, and I've heard you a little bit here, and I've heard you in lots of other places testify of Joseph Smith as a prophet. I'd just love to hear about your experience in reading and coming to know Joseph Smith and how that has affected your testimony of Joseph Smith.
Well, in the first place, I have immense admiration for him. Partly his character. I say that one of his outstanding characteristics is resilience. He had huge problems and difficulties, personal in his own family with loss of children, never had enough money. He was beat up by neighbors. And he was disappointed. You know, when he loses the strongholds in Missouri, one after another, Jackson County, Clay County, and then the far west area, someone told him, said to him about 1839, says, "Joseph, everything you've tried has failed." And you have to sort of say, well, in a way, that's true. They're just a scraggly bunch of people clinging to the banks of the Mississippi River, hoping to get started again. So it was one setback after another, and not just his own personal suffering or his family's suffering, but his people. He had put his people through it. And yet he just would not give up. They told him, maybe we better disperse, because it's gathering that led to all the persecution. But he wouldn't. He had this vision of Zion, and he just insisted that we go through that way. So that's one feeling I have about him, that he was very strong, and you have to say, well, he had the backing of Revelation. I think that's true. He couldn't have done it if he didn't have absolute confidence that he was doing, fulfilling God's purposes. So that's one thing I feel about him. The other thing I feel about him is I think he must be the greatest revelator of all time. Mm. All the things he did, strange, unusual things. I mean, when he gets started, he isn't a preacher. He gets started with a vision, just like other people had visions, but he produces a history book, a second Bible, someone with very little education, and he claims to have translated it, which is not what people with his education did, and there's no precedent for a divine translator. Mm. So, you know, it just comes out, and then you know, a 1,000-year history, you can't just write a 1,000-year history with all its depth, bears up under so much scrutiny. So, and then it sort of goes on for there. Then he organizes a church, and it sort of has the outlines of a Methodist-type church. And then he's told he not only has a church, he has to found a city. He's to create a whole society. So there's Zion. And so it goes on, and it's sort of amusing. He kept saying, after he'd get one of these revelations, says, well, now we have the revelations. All we have to do is live them. But then he has to start a temple. And then he has to establish a priesthood. And, you know, one thing after another, huge, demanding projects of exploring parts of the religious world that were really quite unfamiliar to him. And so it goes on down to the end. Baptism for the dead is there at the end, and one thing after another. So I think it's just a magnificent achievement, let's put it that way, in terms of prophetic creativity, prophetic vision, prophetic aspiration. So I feel pretty strongly about him that way too.
Thank you. We appreciate that. We're grateful. It's just a privilege to be learning here with you. I believe that we've all been edified. We'll have a couple little extra things on the Patreon website, as I said. And we want to encourage our audience to share some of what they've learned today with someone else. If it helped you understand scripture in some way, if it edified you in some way, please, you know, you can post about it on social media and like and download and comment, but also reach out to someone in person. We'd also love to have you join us next week when Janice Johnson is going to talk to us about sections 6-8. She has a lot of wonderful things to say on that. So we'd love to welcome you to join us on there. And we just want to one last time thank Dr. Bushman for his time with us. Thank you.